Okay. All right. Today is November 21st, 2014. And this is Karen Brewster and Dave Klein. And Dave, you were talking about regular faculty coffee breaks in
Yeah,
the department.
which sometimes you'd be frustrated because, and we'd eat frequently, if bring a bag lunch and sit in there in the same room and have lunch. And
And I should say this was when, what was it, Peter Morrison
Peter Morrison
was
was
head of IAB.
the head of the Institute of Arctic Biology after Lawrence Irving, who founded it, and he was good at operating this kind of research institute when it was a new biological research institute. The Geophysical Institute was first, and institutes had to be they had to have their own organizational structure, including their own accounting, budgeting, etc. And the university was, I mean, it was sort of like they were just having the space available that the university provided, and the university didn't have too much power over them. And of course, it gradually shifted because they were part of the university system. They couldn't be the ones that were running it, although early on, yeah, they were having, in terms of funding being brought in, yeah, they were had a lot of power that was hard for them to relinquish when the university and regents and everything wanted them to behave more like a component of the university. But at any rate, these discussions with the head of the Institute of Arctic Biology, and then later it merged with the teaching, and that was called for a while the Division of Life Sciences. It's included then biology and wildlife, as and that was mainly took place during a term when we had this Englishman who was the director. I'll think of his name. At any rate, those breaks were nice because you socialized a bit, and that's nice. You kept in touch, and sometimes someone was some tend to brag a lot about what they were doing or their students. Others, weren't necessarily braggers, but they would have pride in what was being done by their people. And so and then there was a good thing about an institute. Yeah, there were researchers working together as a team, and that's one of the big advantages of the institute. And then they treated me as part of the institute, even though it was mostly related to graduate student and in the early days, master's students working through the cooperative unit, where I was able to bring in small amounts of money to support the students, where they were bringing out money to support the professors that were doing big research projects, and maybe sometimes they could get a student stipend involved in it. But they admired the fact that the cooperative unit program made it possible for them to sometimes serve on graduate committees or be major advisors, even other faculty, and where I couldn't be responsible for all of them, and the subject area might be more along the lines of people in the on the faculty of the institute. But it was a nice way to do it socially. And then we had these foreign exchanges with especially Norwegians, and but and we occasionally had others. But I remember some of the discussions with Norwegians were they were great, especially lunch. And we connect, it was easy to connect Alaskans to connect with Norwegians. We had a lot of the same interests. We appreciated the environment we lived in. Many of them were skiers and working with caribou or reindeer, and so we had worked together in the field, or but Then they began appreciating, which I always have when I've been abroad, you know, getting their views of the people that live in the country about world issues, you know, the Cold War, right, for example, and the world in general. And I remember a debate had with this one woman postdoc who, I was pretty attached to her. And she was pretty worldly. She had married a medical doctor, a Norwegian medical doctor, and Tata Ringberg was her name. And she had married a Norwegian medical doctor, and when she was very young, she was a very beautiful woman, and they went to East Africa and where he worked, and it was a good experience. But you know, in those days, she had a couple of babies and two boys, and then suddenly she realized that she wanted to be more than just a mom, and she had sort of an undergraduate degree, but she was interested in physiology and biology, and so she went back to Norway. They went back to Norway, and they got divorced, and I met both of them over there after they were divorced, and I got to know her pretty well, and him as well, and the two sons, and she brought one son with her, and the other son stayed with him, her husband, former husband, and they were just terrific people. I mean, they loved the Tata and her son, and he went to school here. And at any rate, she was as most Norwegians, was up on world events, and we used to debate things. And you know, when I was doing these official exchanges with the Soviet Union under the Nixon-Brezhnev detente agreement, well, the Norwegians, they thought that was a good deal, you know, that they wanted to see better relations between the U.S. and Russia. You know, we'd been allies during the war, but under Stalin and then subsequent, they were so hard-nosed communists, and Americans got paranoia about communism, and so, you know, that was the Cold War. And so it was a kind of breakthrough. And then I, as an ecologist, working with mostly with big ungulates, caribou and musk oxen and moose and mountain sheep and mountain goats, I was interested in their evolution, which that was mostly in Africa. So I figured Africa and that's where evolution of ungulates got started, and I was eager to get there because it meant so much good work going on there, biological, ecological, and behavioral. And so I made a connection at one international meeting in Scandinavia, I think, and asked about, to some South Africans, I asked about the possibility of joining up and doing some research through the Mammal Research Institute at the University of Pretoria, which was run by an Englishman, but this was under the nationalistic government in apartheid, and so the people there were the faculty or biologists that were working there were a mixture of both English speaking and origins as well as Afrikaans, no blacks, and then there were foreigners like myself. There was a outstanding Israel biologist who was working with porcupines and the European porcupines, and then it was just a very stimulating environment, but they organized, got some funding from the South African Research National Science Foundation, something like that, and to cover some salary for me and living expenses, not much salary, but living expenses, and I had to give a few talks. But it was mostly doing research with one of their biologists who was a specialist on radioactive isotope tracers, but also physiology and water transfer and water relationships of ungulates. And that I was interested in how the ungulates dealt differently with water. And so I worked out together that I wanted to compare an ungulate that two ungulate species that were somewhat similar, and Impala was one that was a lot known about, and the blessed buck was another, which is like a difference between a mule deer and a white-tailed deer in size. And one was definitely dryland area, and the other one was more of a savanna than Impala. But they both had to go through this period of summer drought and the rains and high quality forage and then poor quality forage. And how did they do it? And so I was interested in, well, how they did this, and working with this physiologist, that was a good deal, and he was a good guy. And I forgot his name at the moment. We published together. And so, but anyway, going back to...
Does this go back to these coffee breaks?
Yeah, back into the coffee break. Then I remember Tada was saying, well, how come you're going to South Africa? They got this Africans, the nationalistic government that the blacks don't have a vote, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, I went to... I said, it's science, and there's good scientists there, and it's not political. And that's the same reason I went to Soviet Union on an exchange. Yeah, there was these people I was working with were part of the Soviet Union, but they were scientists too. And I believed that, and I thought, so we had a long discussion, and I, of course, won over on that one because he agreed eventually that was it. But he liked to challenge these things. And
now, you had mentioned that these coffee breaks were the research faculty, that the teaching faculty did not participate in these.
Well,
and why?
Early on, they were separate. The institutes, the same with the geophysics, they had research people. They didn't have... if they were going to be teaching, they had to have a split appointment with the teaching department. And geophysics, say, one or two had some kind of a split appointment to teach physics and things like that. But these are core courses, and they weren't... everything was on the... In the institutes was on the research.
So you could be a... faculty member at the Institute of Arctic Biology and do research and not teach.
Yeah, many of them. But they had a base salary, but they had to bring in, they were expected to bring in research funding and some of their salary if they got big grants.
Right.
So there was always the real pressure on those that when a grant would run out and they would have to spend time trying to get a new grant, and of course, there's no sure thing there. So the director's job was to try to encourage them and stimulate them and assist as possible, and maybe recommend that they team up with somebody else because they could both do a better proposal if they're working as a team. And that's one of the advantages of an institute. Yeah, and so they did some of that.
I didn't realize that you could be a faculty member and not have teaching obligations. I thought all faculty had to teach.
No, it's changed markedly now.
Okay.
And when it became, when they merged, they still maintained their identity, but they merged it into a division of life sciences.
So the institute and the Department of Biology got...
The faculty were merged into that. And so then faculty would have... would part of their salary would be paid for by teaching, and that was usually state budget, and part of their research time would be paid from the research grants they were working on through the Institute of Robotic Biology. So that was to make essentially them. Because there were these debates, of course, at all universities, especially at that time when this was going on at other universities as well. The research faculty were sort of elitist because they had this money to pay for their research. They didn't have to teach. And then the people that were doing the teaching were underpaid compared to them.
And they didn't have time to do research if they were doing all the teaching, right? Or did they do research?
They didn't have time to write proposals to do the research. That's right, and they had a heavy teaching load.
And so the research faculty, they had graduate students though, even though they weren't teaching, they still mentored students.
There was this transition period of several years, 8 or 10 years at least, when some of them would, some research faculty would volunteer to spend some time teaching. Maybe they were encouraged because they were running low on their research funding, but they were still doing research. So they literally bought out of their...
But a research faculty could serve on graduate committees and have graduate students that they mentored, even if they weren't teaching in a classroom.
They could, that's true.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did they?
But it didn't... Yes, a few did, but... From their perspective, they didn't get, that took a lot of time.
Oh, and that wasn't included in their grants, to have time to do that?
Well, it depended on the grant, but it depended on policy at the National Science Foundation and how well you could, if you could justify it. And the debate of whether you could have, whether a person could be a good teacher without doing any research, and vice versa, whether you could be a good researcher without doing some teaching. And, in my view, most teachers, and I say most, that doing a good job would... doing some research too, or at least had experience as research. But on the other hand, we had some outstanding researchers that didn't do any teaching and some outstanding teachers who didn't do any research. They loved teaching and they kept up on the latest research that was being done, but it wasn't the hands-on themselves. So it's like this, no perfect fit, no perfect, and that's what I think is important in a university. You don't have strict rules that are going to force everyone into the same slot.
Well, how did that work then with tenure? Or was tenure not an issue back when it was separate?
At the beginning, there was no tenure for faculty, period. And so you were under some kind of a contract. And the same was true for the institutes. And they could, maybe if you've been there for a while, you had a 2-year contract. If you're new, you had a 1-year contract. And if you're successful in bringing in more grant money and you're doing good research and well-funded, there wasn't any problem of getting a renewed contract. And if you, same with teaching, if you were doing a good job at teaching, but in teaching it got more political because it was budgets were smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And if the budgets got short, what do you do? I mean, you have to, you don't fill a position if someone is doesn't stay. And so you don't, there's always shortage of, and that was terrible under those conditions because you didn't have the academic freedom of speech, and that, you know, the Firecracker Boys thing happened during that era,
mm-hmm.
and the administration was too powerful, and the faculty and the university didn't have any power technically, and they were just, we got organized, and I played a role here, but I had to be very sensitive in playing that role because the federal government, I have bosses in the federal government mm-hmm. who were technically responsible for me. I was employee of
them. You were Fish and Wildlife Service employee.
But I also had a contract with the university, and there was with no money involved that made me a full faculty member. So there was no tenure for either in either programs, but the federal government had a merit system, so they couldn't just arbitrarily fire you. It was something like tenure, and you had to go through review every 3 or 4 years, which was complex. It would be something like a tenure review or
right.
advancement. And you did have to go through advancement from assistant professor to associate professor to full professor. And there were politics involved there. I mean, I got involved with National Association of University Professors, which was really the only appeal source if you were, you know, summarily dismissed in faculty and summarily dismissed. You couldn't, there was no place to go in the university system. And this was not uncommon for state universities at that time. We were a little slow up here, but not much.
There wasn't a union.
There was no union, and there was no tenure, and no standardized review process for advancement. Who recommended you for advancement? It was your department head, and that department head had to go through the dean. There wasn't necessarily a review by peers.
Mm.
And there was no sabbatical.
So you mentioned the department, so that the researchers were at the institute and then the teaching faculty were in the department. What department was that? Department of Biology?
Biology and Wildlife.
That was one department, okay.
But at one time there was a department of Fisheries and Wildlife, I think, and then the Department of Biology, and that didn't make sense, but they were merged together later on. But it made some sense because they were applied biology, applied science.
So is the department currently still the Department of Biology and Wildlife? Okay, they still won.
Yeah, and within the College of Natural Sciences.
Right, and then that is still separate from the Institute of Arctic Biology?
No. Then we used to...
Because there isn't a Department of Life Sciences anymore, is there? You mentioned that. No, that went away.
That was a division.
Oh, that was a division. Sciences.
And so that included fisheries then, too. There was no Institute of Marine Science. And then the wildlife unit... merged with, there was pressure nationally with the co-op unit program to merge fishery units with wildlife units.
Right.
The fishery unit got started about must have been about 80 in the 80s sometimes, 1980s, whereas the wildlife unit's 1950.
Right.
So then we
but
had
then
a,
those two merged. I remember you said that before.
They didn't merge at first. They were independent, or they were both cooperative units.
Right.
But one was fisheries, and we worked together, the fishery unit guy and me, at times. And we'd have an annual meeting where both were there at some place.
The fisheries cooperative unit approached things similarly to you. It was funding for graduate students through Fish and Wildlife.
Department of Fish and Game, that was a department of sport fisheries primarily, but sometime commercial fisheries, that provided support for the cooperative fishery unit, and was Department of Wildlife, Division of Wildlife Conservation, that provided out of their budget the money for the wildlife unit.
Right. But on the federal level, the fisheries, was that Fish and Wildlife also?
Yeah, both were Fish and Wildlife.
Okay.
Until under the Reagan administration, they tried a budget cut, and they decided to take research components out of the federal management agencies, the Forest Service, the Park Service, BLM, and Fish and Wildlife Service, and put them all into under the Department of the Geological Survey. And
okay.
So the Geological Survey was another one, that, and they merged them all together, and they put them under the Geological Survey. They could have put them under the Fish and Wildlife or the Park Service, but that seemed, at the time, was the best way to do it. And partly because the Geological Survey was not tied in with the applied management.
Yeah, I was going to say, it has been always an agency that's more just research. They don't manage the resources,
right,
where the other ones were doing both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So at any rate,
is that where the Biological Survey came in? Isn't there a National Biological Survey or something like that?
Yeah, that was before the when I first went to work as a unit leader. It was the Bureau of Sport Fisheries and Wildlife.
In Fish and Wildlife Service?
Yeah, but it wasn't called the Fish and Wildlife Service. It was Biological Survey or something like that.
Hmm.
And then the Fish and Wildlife Service came into reality after that.
Okay.
By changing the name.
But so we were talking, though, about the Institute of Arctic Biology and the Department of Biology and Wildlife. They are now one entity?
No.
They're separate.
We're a component within the Institute of Arctic Biology, and then we're tied also to the Department of Biology and Wildlife.
So the cooperative unit was? Is that what
yeah.
you mean by we? You were connected to both, okay.
And now with the Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit, the Alaska one, some of the faculty in wildlife have appointments as faculty members through the Biology and Wildlife, but they're fully salaried by the Fish and Wildlife Service, or no, by the Geological Survey now, yeah. And so the university doesn't kick in. The university kicks in for the office secretary,
right,
that kind of stuff. But under the fisheries people, some of them, most of them are, their connection is with, not with the, they're with mostly with the Biology and Wildlife, but some of them are with the Institute of Marine Science.
Right.
And they have a teaching program too, the School of Fisheries.
Right.
And so they have their appointment there, but they're part of the co-op unit as well.
But so the current Department of Biology and Wildlife is its own thing. It's not under IAB.
No.
No, it's separate.
So they have separate budgets, and one is directly through the university, and the other is through the Institute of Audiobiology. Well, it has to go through the dean's office. That would be the College of Natural Sciences, and for the biology and wildlife.
And
along with the geology department and physics,
right.
Et cetera.
So it's still that the Institute of Arctic Biology still is a research institute which relies on grant funding. They don't get so much funding from the university. The teaching department gets more.
Right, but their members are... Well,
they cross-pollinate.
Well, not more than that. Every member of the Institute of Arctic Biology has a teaching appointment through the college. They may be sometimes full research because they literally, to do that, they're buying out of... They don't get any salary for teaching.
Right. So now it's more mixed. Before, when you were talking about people either just did research or just taught, that was... previous time period. Now, if you work at Institute of Arctic Biology, you do both research and teach.
Yeah, more or less.
Okay, unless you buy it out through a grant.
And then there's a few people that have split appointments, like not necessarily through the institute, but they might. Somebody working with a museum, Derek Sykes, he's also teaches occasional courses.
Right.
And then there are several others.
Right, that works for other parts, like at the museum.
Yeah.
You do anthropology, you teach,
exactly.
And you also work. That's standard.
Yeah.
Then the
budgeting for the department goes down through the university system, and the Institute of Arctic Biology goes down through the university system as well, but they have their own budget office. Whereas the department head has to live within a budget, but he has to work closely with the dean's office and mainly the dean's office, yeah.
Yeah, it is a little confusing. Thank you for explaining that. We kind of got off topic. But
the bigger they get, the more of that.
Well, and also it's confusing because it changed from when you started the what faculty did in research and teaching and these different institutes and departments was a different relationship than what it is now.
That's right.
Like the Institute of Arctic Biology wasn't even there, was it, when you started? It came later?
Not much later. I came there in 62. They probably started about maybe a year or two earlier.
Oh, I was thinking it wasn't there. When I said when you came, I meant when you came as a graduate student.
Oh, not as a graduate student, no. The only institute then was the Geophysical Institute down in the old Chapman building.
Right. Well, anyway, I got us off topic because we were talking about these coffee group meetings and how you were talking about how
they were nice,
the camaraderie and exchange of ideas
and that frequently when I was doing research in Denmark and at the University of Oslo on a sabbatical, they had similar kind of coffee breaks that people would come to, and it was good, and especially for me as a visitor. It was good because that was part of it, and that was less formal. And sometimes there at the University of Oslo, the department head couldn't make it very often because he was busy being an administrator and didn't. He had a lot more under his.
Well, you said the same here, that the director didn't always make it coffee breaks. But you were... in the position with head of the cooperative unit, that
There were times when I couldn't make it.
No, but that you were sort of affiliated with both organizations, yeah. So you could do both.
I was like a mini institute within an institute, yeah. In fact, I was, that's the way the university administration saw me.
You were an institute within an institute?
I was a director of an institute, but it was within the Institute of Artibiology. And so as a director of an institute, even though when I first started, it was just me plus a secretary.
Right.
That was it. But I was, because it was an administrative unit that was semi-independent by the cooperative agreement that was designed to be that way, then I was expected to sit in on the directors and deans meetings, which was a good experience for me because I was pretty much the youngest one there. And also, you know, technically much less power than the others because they had a lot of more faculty under them. But nevertheless, they treated me, and at first I thought this was just a formality, but then I began to realize it was important that they recognize the existence of the unit, because there was a lot of new people came in, and it was hard to understand what the unit was. And I became convinced the value of the wildlife unit, and still think it was and is a great concept, because it brings these different state and federal government together, plus the Wildlife Management Institute, which is just a private lobbying organization for hunting and fishing activities.
You want to say you had the benefit of, you could kind of play at all levels. You could be a dean director because you're head of an institute. You also could interact with faculty, and yeah. You also could interact with students. So you kind of got to do all of it.
Well, that's true. And being so remote from Washington, D.C. at the University of Alaska, other unit leaders in other states closer, you know, Pennsylvania and other places, that I got to know because from annual meetings and what, and we had a few exchanges, and they envied it in some ways because I was less under the nose of the Fish and Wildlife Service. On the other hand, I knew that there was going to be closer scrutiny because what I was doing by the federal government, but at the same time, I believed in the whole concept of you're working for two bosses, and the main reason we existed was to train at the graduate level young people for positions with state and federal agencies or in other places. It was mostly state and federal agencies, which are their employers, and I thought this was a wonderful way to do it because students would easily get exposure to both state and federal agencies, and sometimes the agencies would be providing in-kind support with aircraft assistance, getting out in the field and what. Then the students were meeting these people, the biologists from the state and federal, with potential employers of them. And so it meant their employment was better assured if they did a good job in their degree.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm now responsible for getting us totally off topic of what we were going to talk about. So
it's okay. It's all background. That's just important.
So I'm going to pull us back around to something. I have a note from a previous interview about modeling and the concept in science and biology of doing modeling versus, I suppose, doing field work. Is that what you wanted to talk about? My note means?
Let's do it because
it ties into.
I don't remember the date, but probably back in the early 90s, there began to be this focus on modeling, because ecological and biological systems were understood to be horribly complex, and we were getting better at getting data for these from these variables because of new technologies like radio collars, and so we could monitor movements of animals and then, you know, get information on life history and behavior and how that affected to land uses that were the animals, which was their animals' habitat, whether it was forestry or agriculture or what. And that was, there were one or two eager beaver young scientists, biologists, now working with wildlife, that jumped into the modeling. One of the reasons maybe why I was skeptical about modeling it early on was because I was never very strong in statistics, and modeling required a pretty high level of understanding of computer modeling. This was all computer modeling, but the concept of modeling was dependent upon the computer to integrate information that could be better understood if it was put into a model, and you knew how much input each component of the model played, and there were, to make the model work better, you had to get more data. But early on, they were mostly just conceptual models. Well, that part of it I thought was okay, because you had to look at a complex system and not simplify it to just working on components which seemed to be important, like hunter harvest versus population dynamics. That's not enough. You got to factor in other things, disease, weather, predation, what have you.
Well, isn't the quality of the output of a model only as good as the input of the data you have?
Yeah, definitely. That's the case. But on the other hand, the models, the big problem with the modeling becoming popular was that models were expected to serve two functions. The first was to better understand the system. That meant you built a model and you put different boxes. You did a graphic model, you had these different boxes and as input into the target species, mm-hmm. say, or population. And that included, habitat quality and grazing pressure, and then you have radiation, and you have extreme conditions like winter, and how did that change the physiological demands of the animal, and how did you have to plug in the physiological changes in relationship to reproduction, and especially bearing young and lactation, and relate that to the food supply and the quality. It gets pretty complex, but that's the real world. And if you're going to understand it, you should better understand it than if you just do this on a piecemeal basis. Mm-hmm. You just focus on one or two relationships, which is the way you used to do it. So
what was the second function of modeling? You said it had two functions.
Well, the other function is, what was your long-term goal? Was to be able to use the model and predict what would happen if there were the variables changed, like if the climate changed, or if the big fire, for example, on the range of the moose, or caribou or whatever. What happens if you had a disease outbreak, and how did the animals respond? The surviving ones respond. For managing, say, harvests of them and understanding population dynamics, you know, it sounds great to have a model to do this. The problem is, once you build a model and you put a lot of effort into getting data, if you don't have data that you should have, you say, well, it's probably not important, so you don't include it. So some of the variables that maybe you just, best thing is to say that it's not an important variable. And you can do some statistic analysis if you have data that helps you make that judgment, but that it's not reliable because you didn't have any data to work with in that particular variable. It's like insect harassment of caribou. You know, it was just so hard to get any data, and yet we knew it was important. Well, how important in terms of, say, blood loss to mosquitoes and the parasitic flies and the harassment where they can't feed normally? And how does this relate to changing weather conditions?
Yeah, you sort of end up biasing the model based on if you have data or not. As you say, if you don't have the data, oh, it must not be
it's
important.
It's an incomplete model.
Yeah, so you're biasing your outcomes.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, that's true, and it's always going to be true because it's not going to be exactly the same as the real world.
Right.
But your goal was to try to get as close to the real world as possible. Well, of course, some of the complications are that how much is it? You got a limited budget. What's the most important data that you got to get? And where should you put your money there, obviously. But you have to make an arbitrary judgment as what's important. And as human beings, if you're probably more interested in the behavior of caribou under certain stresses and what do they do versus what are the stresses versus insects, for example, where you much rather work observing behavior of caribou than trying to observe the behavior of the insects.
Well, the other thing I was thinking too, when you just said that was the politics at the time, I was thinking about oil development in Prudhoe Bay. When you talk about insect harassment, that's what I think of. And
right.
The priorities of trying to figure out what might happen as the result of some particular development activity, which may or may not be the most important thing for understanding a particular population.
Well, some cases, if the oil industry could, say, challenge biologists, Fish and Game or Fish and Wildlife or whoever is involved, say, we want to build a road between Prudhoe Bay and Kuparik Field, but we want to have the minimal impact on wildlife. Well, then that's a challenge that we should respond to as biologists for those agencies. And we sometimes were able to do that. Well, you don't need a model for that. You need data on movements of animals and how it might change with a road or pipeline, gathering pipeline, with the road versus separate from the road. So there were a lot of things that you could test in the field and learn from that.
So
but you could also, what was done on the way to build, say, a work camp or a permanent workplace for the workers, would you want it? Well, you want it, oil industry wants it where it's most efficient for them. But there could be quite a few places. But if they put them, say, between two lakes, and that's that corridor between the two lakes is where the caribou use to get to the coast, you could see those trails from the air. So right. By aerial reconnaissance, we were able to, my students was able to map out, and it didn't take very long, and provide it to the oil industry. And they said, this is terrific. Yeah, we can move this other place. We don't want to stop the movement of the caribou.
It didn't cost them greatly
to do this beforehand.
Right. So what you're saying is, though, there are times where a model can be useful and important, and other times you don't need a model. You can just do data collection.
A model would be more important in Why is the population going up or down or stable? What are these variables? What are their influences? And how important is insect harassment in the summer overall? Well, you got to have data on how many days they're influenced and how many hours a day they can't forage properly. How much energy is expended in trying to grouping together and moving versus as they're in separate, they're running around to get rid of the mosquitoes. So they go together, and that reduces the harassment per group. They can't feed when they're grouped together, and then they want to move to the coast. And if they can't get there because of traffic on the road, so that's where a model works well. But then you got, for the population dynamics over time, you got the whole ecosystem that you should be thinking of. Because you got, what about the predators? Do you know what the population levels are and how they're fluctuating with regard to the population of the target species, the caribou in that case, and the bears, and how the bears, they don't get along in the oil field very well because they get into trouble. So we reduce them, move them out. Well, was that a factor? Yeah, it was a factor in allowing the caribou to decrease the predation level on the new young-born caribou. And they were a long way from the mountains, and wolves don't do away well year-round out there in the flats. So they like to be in the mountains where there's other prey like sheep and moose, and in addition to the caribou, and the caribou are only seasonally there. So then you have justification for whole ecosystem level modeling. But the tendency for biologists to work primarily with one species, and so they don't want to mess with the whole ecosystem. It's when you start asking questions about oil development in NPIRA that you need ecosystem models. And a lot of that input, it comes from satellite imagery on what's the habitat quality at different times of year in different places. Is it high center polygons or is it hills? Does it have high ratio of dwarf willow to tussock grass sedges and all of these things? And then you put quality value at different seasons for each of those components. So then you get a model like that, and they did a pretty good job. The best model was the porcupine herd, and that was because of this D2 legislation, which said we need more information on to allow more seismic exploration for oil, but also what are the potential consequences we need to know about the fish and wildlife populations and that how they might be affected.
Well, so. And also nowadays, modeling seems to be used quite a lot when you're dealing with these issues of climate change. And,
example.
The complex system of, what happens? We have all these variables, so what happens if we change what's happening because now there's going to be less sea ice and how that affects, or the temperature is going to go up and what that's going to do to the forest fire rate and things like that. That kind of modeling I can kind of see, but I'm not sure modeling biological species.
No, I mean, you're modeling components of ecosystems and the species components. It's like if you want to, models are used in, say, human health. I mean, you got to have all this information about your body. Mm-hmm. And if you have, with computers, you can plug that in. Whereas, one doctor who's worked for years has got a lot of it up there, but then someone comes in and doesn't quite fit. If he has a model or she has a model, the computers now can help with the diagnosis. And that That makes sense. When we use models, we've always used models. I mean, it's sort of like when you're building a house, you have a plan.
Yeah.
And if you stick to the plan, you usually end up with something that's pretty close to what you wanted. But you see that it was short in some things because you didn't put things in that should have been in there at the time.
Right.
So, I mean, we use models, and so, you know, I've subsequently appreciated the value of models, but it's just like computers. Computers aren't going to solve our problems. We have to use computers to help us solve our problems. Mm-hmm. It's a tool, and the models are tools. And you've got to know their limitations if you're going to use them. And the problem is that good modelers are doing a terrific job, but then when the member of Congress or legislature or something wants to know, well, you're doing modeling, what's going to happen? Well, that's a predictive model. And models are not very reliable for prediction because there's these variables, we don't have enough. The irony of this modeling something for effect of climate change, when climate change itself is a model. So we don't know what the future holds in store. We used to have a pretty good idea that the weather would be similar to what it's been for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. But now they've got models.
Well, but isn't the idea of a model is you can plug in a different number for the temperature and see what happens?
Yeah, if you got those temperatures. But then the big problem with the modeling now is the climate modelers say, we can't predict what's going to happen locally because we need regional models, especially when you got variables which they don't have data to deal with, like what about the mountains that are interfering with the wind? And mountains in the Arctic that interfere with the cold influence from the frozen ice, if you're inland, on the inland side of those mountains, it's much...
They just don't have the data.
We don't have... They're putting out more of these remote climate recording devices, and it's improving all the time. But still, when you realize, say, in the lower 48, where you have so much climate data for within the state, which was a fraction of the size of Alaska, and we don't have communities and villages in all of these places, so it has to be some kind of remote system, which is pretty expensive to put out there, and they're not totally immune to freezing up and blown over or chewed up by a bear or something.
Well, it's interesting, though. You say that models are not very reliable for as predictive things. Can you explain that? Because I think of a model as exactly that's what it is. It's to try and predict what could happen. So can you explain that?
The value of the model is it helps us to understand the complexity. But it doesn't provide the detailed information to use it as a predictor of the future. So we can say if things change the way we think it's going to change, but that's all speculation too. I mean, look what happens. We had this unusual spring, and we have unusual winter. The models, the climate models, are mostly focusing on temperature, and the climate modelers say, when it comes to precipitation, we're kind of at a loss because when we can't model cloud cover with regard to precipitation. It's like we had a lot of cloudy weather last winter, and we didn't have very much snow. And this now, in early winter, we're not having a lot of cloudy weather, and we're not having much snow also.
Right.
And back in the old days, when it got cloudy, it got warmer and snowed.
Right. So if models are not meant as predictors of the future, why do people use them?
they help us understand the systems.
Okay.
So that's their educational role for us, is the primary value of models. The problem is, it's tempting for the even for the modelers, but for people that don't understand models, they think models are let's model something and determine what the future is going to be. It's not. We're dealing with the past, information from the past, and when everything is changing with the current in relationship to weather, it doesn't work. The animals, we can make models for the animals, but then, and if we do a good job with the vegetation and everything, then we might be able to say, well, if the weather is this as it was for the last 5 years and doesn't vary too highly from it, this is what is likely to happen. But then there's these unknowns. No matter how hard we try, we find, oh, this is a goddamn new disease. We didn't even know it was there, and we discovered it. And it couldn't have been too important in the past, but is it going to be important now just because the climate is changing? Yeah, it might be. Those are the problems with modeling, that's some of the problems. But the worst problem is that the funding agencies are dependent upon support from Congress or state legislatures, and they need to move ahead. And so they frequently use incomplete models, and then if it doesn't turn out the way the incomplete model predicted it, then the public loses faith in the scientists, even though they may have warned or cautioned that this is the model we have, but it's not too reliable. And it's the same place with doctors making diagnoses and then a second diagnosis, so it's more complex, where they have more facilities to do it. No, the first one wasn't right.
Or it's like the media who predicts the outcome of an election and then it doesn't come out that way.
Exactly.
The count comes in. But I was wondering with models, you know, what you sort of said, it's tempting to use them in this predictive way. I was wondering, yeah, how is it that they're not supposed to be used as predictors, but our culture is now so focused on using them that way? How did that happen?
Well, this one last project that was a big modeling project I was involved with was one for the based on the porcupine herd. And this was funding. I was involved in this mainly as an advisor, sort of a senior scientist as an advisor, because I wasn't in a position to be an active person getting, I was retired and getting paid to be in the field and to collect data and put the model together. So they had top-notch modelers, a guy originally from South Africa, a young guy who worked with a real star in environmental modeling from the University of Minnesota, I think. And he came up here, and both of them, and then they have work, they were modeling caribou, the porcupine herd, in relationship to the native people that were dependent upon it. So that was a sociological study that would need data to go into the model too. And that some of that data could be what the native people were interested in the model, because we had good data, pretty good data on the caribou and the numbers, their distribution, the use of habitats, and the physiological condition and all of these things that would getting better all the time. And then, but then what happened if they decided mostly to winter in Porcupine or in the, upper Porcupine versus lower Arctic Village, for example, versus Old Crow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the model was interactive, which was a great way to go, so that you could take it into the schools, and here's a model, and now plug in, raise the temperature during the summer. You could plug that in, and then bingo, the thing would rip out, and it was not only interactive, but they did a good job with showing groups of caribou moving across maps in relationship to going to the calving ground, and how snow cover, if you manipulated snow cover, how it would affect the timing of their arrival there. And this was terrific because it convinced the local people that, they already knew a lot of this, but they could see that they're all interacting. All these things are interacting. And it's a very complex system. But that just because it's complex, you shouldn't ignore it. And you shouldn't just, say, well, last year it did this, it'll probably do this same thing this year, et cetera. And then you have these extreme events, which the climate models predict. Every once in a while, you have an extreme, well, it's happening with snow in the central part of the United States. And, now they know more about why it's happening, but the climate models were predicting increased extreme events.
Hmm.
But that could be increased drought or increased flooding. And this is, in terms of people, this is important information, but it doesn't help too much if you can't say when they're going to occur. And that's what the modelers said. We can't predict their frequency. Well, they're going to be extreme events, and they're going to be more extreme than they have in the past. Like hurricanes are going to be more extreme and not necessarily more common. And it has to be plugged into the temperature of the sea at where they generate in order to know whether they're going to materialize. But then whether they're going to be a sandy disaster and flood New York City or not, we can't predict
right.
that. And we even have trouble once it's already heading that direction to know specifically, because it's all these various variables in the weather.
Mm-hmm.
And so the same applies really to the models. But at any rate, the nice thing about that Porcupine caribou model was that they used it in the schools in Arctic Village and Old Crow, and the school kids, just loved it. And they realized they learned a hell of a lot. And then you could take that to Washington, D.C. and talk to members of Congress. Maybe there was some that weren't capable, occasional representative from Alaska, and seeing it all. But when they saw this, and then you say, the kids were able to show that such and such is such and such, and you can do it too, then they began to see, this... And that means that the natives know more about, we already knew they knew a hell of a lot, but now they know more, and they're able to rate that to models. And they see the relationship there where this, because the Crow people didn't have, and the Arctic Village didn't have data on or experience in the calving grounds. Well, it's all in there in the model. And they had good people here, Brad Griffith and others, who were early competent people and worked on this. They weren't necessarily competent people and explaining things to the native people, so that it took some sociologists or anthropologists with at least people with that kind of experience to go there. And then the big sad thing was there had been a lot of money gone into this, and they had real pride in it. And so they wanted to publish, of course. But the deal was that Native people would only go into it if they said, well, wait a second, if you're going to use it, publish it, it's going to have political influence. We want more control on whether it's going to be published in a way that it would be maybe hurtful to us, because people might not understand the other complexities of their cultural relationship that wasn't, say, in the model, and what they want, what they really wanted. I mean, they have these options that you could, in an interactive one, which some of them were really pretty complex, but they at least showed, you know, did they want more tourism? Did they want roads into the villages? If those roads were going to interfere in the movement of the animals and make them less available, did they want that? Or did they, what about some development if it could be controlled and the impact would not eliminate the porcupine herd, but maybe reduce it somewhat? And well, the oil industry liked that kind of approach, and so the only problem was, and they caribou wouldn't have to migrate so far, and they wouldn't be available for the people in the villages. And so this was helping people to stop expecting the impossible, and whether they're oil people or the biologists doing the studies or the media or politicians. So that's this model has done a lot of good. And it's surprising, when I was over in, because I was involved in that, and it wasn't, portions of it were published finally, but the first ones were shut down by the Native community, and it was hard to take, but that was the agreement. Otherwise, the Natives wouldn't have participated. And the social science aspect of it, and that makes sense. But then it turned out, yeah, it could be used if with some qualifications, and then it was okay.
It's interesting that models can be used, just like any facts, they can be used one way or the other to prove a point.
Yeah.
And the Natives were concerned about that.
Because the interactive one, you can alter one of these variables,
right.
And then it only takes a fraction of a few minutes to model to give you a feedback, and that's good. So you can kind of play games with it, and then the kids doing that, they get so that, you know, that's not going to, we know what's going to happen if you do this, you know, if we know it's, and then the adults get into it, and you can relate things that included, you know, where do you want, you need some cash income in the community. Do you want it from tourism? And what are the costs if you have tourism?
Right.
And what kind of tourism, et cetera, et cetera.
So models can be good and bad, it sounds like.
Definitely, yeah. But it's a tool. It's like a computer is a tool.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do, you know, if you're really good with a computer, you can make things look good when they're not really good, vice versa.
Right. Well, you also kind of said that your views on modeling have changed. Like you were originally, when it first started, very much against them. Now that's changed?
No, I wasn't very much against them. I was very skeptical, let's put it that way. And that was because I was mainly concerned that people would be seduced into thinking they were good predictors, and they weren't. They were good to help us learn. And that, I think, we have learned a lot through the use of models. And certainly I've learned that they can be used to help people learn, and especially young people with their minds open in schools. And that's the future of the world, I think, anyway. You're not going to change the minds of politicians if you get to say, oh, we don't like that. We don't like the outcome of that. So we don't like the model, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there other things?
By the way, I wrote this poem once about models.
Oh, yeah.
Which would be a good one in there. And I don't remember it in detail, but it was at a conference that had to do with animal physiology, and it was in Colorado at Fort Collins and the university there. And this guy, I forgot his name, but his name was sort of synonymous with modelers, and there was a big focus and one session on modeling that he was trying to sell it on, and he was a nice guy. I mean, and nice thing about, these people I've worked with, most of them have a good sense of humor. You can kid one another. Since I was sort of a senior biologist there with animal ecology and populations and physiology, working mainly the physiology part with Bob White and others, they asked me to do a summary at the end, the last day. And I don't like those things because it's almost impossible. If you're there, I'm going to get something different than you are out of it. And if you have to do a summary, you approach it altogether different. And it's on your shoulders. And so, I thought, shit, I don't want to do this. So then I started taking notes, and then I started doing some rhyme and stuff. And so then I did the summary in rhyme. And it was joking about a whole bunch of things, including the modeling. And so in doing it, I refreshed the memory of everybody about these sessions, but I didn't draw any conclusions. So it was just, and the concluding one was on modeling. And it went over big. They printed it up, and the coda, I think they called it, the whole thing. They thought that was great. And I did that again once when they had a mammalogical society here. And Terry Boyer, I was just retired. And Terry Boyer was, and I were co-local coordinators for it, getting it going. And so we got a little bit more exposure than, this was a national one, so that, there were other people that played a major role in getting it going. But so then Terry asked me to do another one, summary, and I did that. And that was that published in the American Journal of Mammalogy? I think it was. When they had a summary of that meeting, I think they published that.
And that was also in rhyme?
Yeah. Yeah. But it was, it was the things that were fun about the conference.
Yeah.
But there were a few old-timers that I didn't see the humor in it, but I mean, all
humor.
Of these technical papers, and that's great, and most of them were published, and they were, presentations were made, and that was wonderful. But to repeat all that stuff.
You have to have some humor.
Right. That's why I believe it's important in the world. Yeah, that's important.
Well, this modeling and the emphasis on modeling seems to me a change that's happened in science in general. It sounds like in wildlife and biology.
And it's tied to the availability of good computers and especially, you know, laptops and stuff. And it's amazing how wonderful it is that we can make use of the computers, and then the modeling can be possible. Whereas we use graphic models, you know, and I use them a lot. And giving a paper or something, you know, you could draw these boxes and show the arrows. And especially for animal physiology, they're really good for that. And they're, you know, if you're trying to show, I mean, there was a tendency, you know, in the old days is you show the data you've got here and you show the data you got here and you show the data you got here, and you try to present that to the audience. And even with bar graphs, you lose the focus. People just turn off when, why not show these boxes and arrows going from one to the other, and maybe you don't have the hard data there, but you have enough data to back up each one. And that's a model. It's a graphic model, and that's the way we think. Mm-hmm. So let's do things the way we think, because otherwise, you know, people go to sleep in the audience more readily.
I was wondering if it's changed how people are doing biology. I've heard other scientists or biologists criticize to say that people aren't doing field work. They're now just doing modeling. Do you feel that way?
But I don't blame it on models. I blame it on there's remote sensing. And, you know, like radio collaring and things like that. And
so there's less field work going on because people are using radio collars and remote sensing, so they don't have to be out there observing.
And especially where you're using remote sensing, and I mean the quality of this satellite imagery is so improved. I mean, it's unbelievable that they're now able to use it to actually count whales in the ocean, because a mass of a whale is huge. And when they're up close to the surface, then you can see a difference in the temperature right there where they are from their body. And so now you can get much more accurate information on the number of whales in different parts of the ocean, different times, because satellites are going over there all the time overhead, and you can't afford to fly out there and look. You know, that's the way it remote sensing started, you know, with high altitude flying, and you don't need to do that, and it's too costly. So we can get all this information, and then you have you got to pay for the satellite stuff, but when you realize, if you send airplanes there, it's a fraction. It's so low, the cost. And you get satellite collars on animals that are not too disruptive. And then now they get these little things, and they're plotting movements of birds, for example, like a little shorebird that flies one stop from breeding grounds in the Arctic to Australia.
Wow.
And lands at the same spot each time, or it stops on the beach, stops somewhere, probably presumably on the beach, and they coast to Japan or something, goes down there. And when you never could get that information by being out in the field. But you should be out in the field because you want to know more about the animals, and especially their interaction with the environment and their food. you can't do it that way. And you can get information in the field without killing animals and looking at their guts. And so, or now you can go out in the field and you get feces and you can do tremendous things. And you get DNA that tells you the kind of plants they're eating. It's cost something, but to mount an expedition, you know, the DNA is just some genetic information is so valuable. And we've got the techniques now to isolate what's in the gut and see what animals were eating. And if you find a, say, a mammoth that's frozen and coming out of the gut, coming out, and you can look at what's in the gutter and the feces. And, well, the early humans now, you've got the, they've actually got DNA out of shit in the caves that have, it's about 10,000 years old.
Wow.
And they can get, you can get DNA from the hosts out of it versus how do you separate it? Well, it's separated in the lab because you use some kind of something that's close to it and it'll only look at, so you use modern humans. Mm-hmm. Feces and or DNA to pick that out of the feces, but for the food that they're eating, well, you put in plants that are similar, but they don't have to be the same, but then all the other ones that are similar to that pop out. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it ain't that simple.
No.
But the process is understandable as long as you can do this DNA work. And there's so many amazing things that answer questions that we couldn't answer before, but we can answer with new technology. But I think the DNA is one of the most important ones for any kind of biological work.
Hmm. So do you think students are missing out by not doing field work the way you got to do it?
I do. Not only students, the biologists. If you're out in the field, you can see things, and you see animals doing things that aren't showing up from remote sensing. And remote sensing is wonderful, and especially, you know, plotting habitat changes, but you should be on the ground to ground truth it so you understand what you're seeing. And it's like, what was it? Was it this seminar this afternoon, maybe? I can't recall it, but I raised a question, might have been in another one, but did we know? Oh, that was fire. Yeah, it was this. And you can do a lot with remote sensing on fire, and you know it's, and we're getting improving capabilities, and you can't be everywhere, but you got to do enough, be on the ground enough so that you can be sure of what you're seeing in the remotely versus what is what is actually there, because there are options, and like, oh, the good one is like caribou habitat. It was on the burn too. You know, you get different responses in relationship to the severity of the burn. And you get different, Teresa pointed out this, that was that when you get into the difference between the wetland areas versus upland areas. And and they've, you know, she had students working on these different aspects, and you know, the difference if a severe burn in an upland site is quite different than a lowland site, and then the big question was that was it. She was pointing out that if it was water, which in the wetland, and if it was up on a slope and the permafrost underneath, and then you had a fire, then you could get sedges coming in. Whereas if it, it was drier, you got grasses coming in. Well, yeah, this fits with my understanding of grasses are more drier, mm-hmm. well-drained sites. But then the question is, well, the fire causes increased the depth of the active layer, mm-hmm. which means that right afterwards there's more moisture, but then the moisture drains out in subsequent years faster if there's no frost.
So fire is changing where wetland versus dry may be.
Not only that, but if the water, what's the duration of availability of moisture for plant growth?
Hmm.
Is it just the first few weeks after melt-off, if it's an upland site and it's well-drained, and then the plant, grasses can do well and grow vigorously, and then they senesce.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas sedges need more water to keep going, and it takes them longer, so they need a longer duration of water, even though it might have been the same amount of water, but it was available over a longer period of time. So it's another complexity that you have to factor in, but what those studies are doing is they're trying to answer those questions.
Mm-hmm. I should say it was Teresa Hollingsworth who gave that lecture you're talking about today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she was, some of those were students that were working with her, but she,
right.
She was set them up.
Well, okay. So we've covered modeling.
Good enough for now. It's too complex to give it any more.
We won't give it any more coverage. We shall move on. One of the things I've wanted to talk about, we've done it a little bit, but a little bit more is, you know, you obviously have a belief in the value of conservation and preserving wild places, and you've taken that value and applied it, not only in the science you've done, but in environmental work, right? Can you talk about the application on the environmental side? We've done a lot of talking about the science side. What kind of things did you do in the environmental work?
Okay. But first I'll make one statement that should introduce that.
Okay.
I love life. So living systems, biological systems that are alive, I've got a bias, you know, versus non-living systems. Yet, you know, this paper I'm giving is, I've become fascinated about the geological history of these Bering Sea Islands.
St. Matthew.
Yeah, how it relates to the geological history relates very much to where the seabirds are nesting. And they're... The summary statement is, in terms of coastal erosion, is the harder the rocks, that's where the hardest rocks are, where the cliff nesting, the murres and kittiwakes, mainly those two, but also quite a few others. But they cliff nesters, ledge nesters on cliffs.
Mm-hmm.
And those cliffs are the hardest, and the sea is just, sea level is rising, you have more early winter storms, and they don't erode.
Hmm.
And so they're not being threatened. And they're, of course, they're up higher than the splash, so they're gone anyway by that.
So this is the paper you're preparing to give in Salem,
yeah.
Oregon? Okay.
The coastal erosion is one of, but then the auklets, the little cute right. little locklets. They had a different strategy for selection of nest sites. Their nesting habitat is their crevice nesters. They get onto rocks and boulders that the foxes can't dig into. But they have to come out of those to go out of these rocky deals to go to sea and feed.
Mm-hmm.
And they do this en masse. And then they feed it en masse, like there would be like 40,000 in one
wow.
deal. So they literally swamp the foxes. So one fox goes out there and the red foxes, yeah. So it's twofold, this paper, on the red foxes displacing the arctics. But the red foxes are, they're very territorial, much more so than the arctics around the maternal dens. The arctics are too, but it's not as big a territory. So you can have around an auklet colony with, say, 50,000 auklets there, breeding pairs, not counting the young, and they go there, and it's timing of the day that they come out, and these little locusts sit on the rocks and chirp, and that stimulates all the others to come out at the same time. And then they fly out en masse, and it's a big flock, you know, it darkens the sky almost, and they're gone. And they come back en masse, and then they go back in fairly fast. But when they're coming out, they're sitting ducks for the foxes.
They're sitting auklets, not sitting
yeah,
ducks.
Yeah, that's right. and so, but a fox, you know, they love these auklets because they get young in the back in the den, and the male and the female are both doing this and taking turns, and you know, we see them coming back. They've got like six auklets hanging in their mouths.
Wow!
And you figure, wow, man, they're pretty vulnerable. But when you have 50,000 or 40,000 of them coming out at the same time, they're swamping the predator because it's the only time for them to make one trip back to the den, which is not too far away, but they are farther away. They want to control this and keep the other foxes from getting into this nice feeding area. In the meantime, you know, if they go out and come back with voles hanging out, they much prefer voles to birds normally, but the auklets, both the Arctic and the...
It's too tempting.
It's tempting and just ideal size.
Yeah.
If an Arctic kills a murre, they say, well, if before they lay eggs or when they're just coming back, occasionally when they get some, they're better climbers than the reds. You know, that's a big thing. They have to eat some of it there, and then if they already have pups, they have to carry this big cumbersome thing back. And the pups love to play with the wings and things like that. But it's, you know, you realize that the foxes have a preference, but they also have to produce young, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so do the birds. And so the net effect is, and these auklet colonies are caused by a coastal erosion that has causes these slumps. Mm-hmm. Where does it occur? Where the rock is, if it is rock, it's all, whatever is there is where that happens is underneath maybe a thin layer of lava that's only this thick, but this is explosive erosion. Mm-hmm. It has to be very close to where volcanoes were. There was a big giant volcano out there, I'm convinced. But then there were small craters that were about 2 miles across, relatively small. And surprisingly, I mean, this geology there, I'll show you the whole thing at some time in the future. But we got a satellite. I had aerial photos from the Navy at 6,000 feet, black and white, that were very valuable because they showed you could use those when it was so foggy and it's hard to hike through the country without getting close to a cliff. But the satellite imagery is, they got this, they started trying to collect them in from St. Matthew in 2008. They got one little bit of Hall Island, and then 2009 they got this one that's just a beautiful one, and then they got other ones. But the reason this is beautiful is it the sea, well, you can see the green vegetation. You can see this crater, which I had speculated, but not at first. It wasn't until after we'd been there in 2005, and I'd had those photos from the first time I went out there in 1957. I speculated that these were craters, but Dan Mann looked at them. He didn't see them as such. He saw a lot of other things. And he is a stereo, and I didn't use a stereo. We had stereo images, and they were very valuable, but it's all black and white. So you could see some things. You could see this slump so well that was it's coastal erosion, but it was that and a couple of others around the island were observed by the people, first explorers that got there in early 1800s. They commented on this tumble of rocks that was going down to the sea. But this satellite image shows this deal, and then the sea was calm at the time they did this. And you can see this ash is leaching out of there. And you can see where all of these uncertain places around the island, that's where this pyroclastic ash, other places it's just basalt and really hard stuff. And these cliffs and other stuff. So it's all, then the birds, of course, selected these locations. Coastal erosion there for the auklets, it's actually some active slumps now. Mm-hmm. We spotted those with the satellite imagery. Only one place where we saw it. It was bulge going out into the sea, a fan, all tumbled rocks. And that one has been there for 5 or 6 years, and no, 7 or 8, and this auklets are starting to nest in it. So coastal erosion for the auklets is not creating a problem, nor is it for the others. Mm-hmm. But the islands are getting smaller because they are eroding. So if you're looking at it from geological time in thousands of years, yeah, they're getting smaller, and eventually they will be lost. But at the present time, no.
Well, it's fun to hear you talk about this, but it's fun to sit here and see you talk about it. I can hear and see the excitement that you get when you're into a topic like this and figuring it out, and there's the scientist in you. So it's really cool that, you know, even now, you know, Professor Emeritus retired, that you still get excited like a little kid.
I've always been this a detective work. That's what the reindeer study I did out there was, the same thing, a detective work. And that a lot of nature study is that. And we used to, you know, that's the advantage of being sort of a naturalist and going out in the old days. People would go out there and get familiar with it, and then they would try to explain things. Well, we didn't have any other information. Well, they frequently were pretty close to being right, or sometimes they were absolutely right. And then when science came along, some of these same naturalists became scientists, like the Murray brothers, and man, they were so much better scientists because of the being on the ground and observing things and handicapped in many ways compared to the world today, but it still is so damned important. And it's like, you know, I've been learning so much while I'm sitting here working on this computer, and the birds are coming to the feeder. Some suet out there. And I see so many things about bird behavior. And then I look and there's voles out there feeding at the same time that the chickadees are there. Now, I'm convinced that they hear the chickadees chirping and they go out there because there's a lot of chickadees and several voles coming out at that time. You don't usually see the voles unless the birds are coming out. So it's predator,
but it's just a really
predator avoidance strategy. Yeah. I mean, join these other little things. They get along fine with one another. Because it's like chickadees only do this. They don't do it in the breeding season. They become very disappear, goes off by themselves.
Mm-hmm. But it's fun to see you talk about these things because you do. You get so excited, and I see it's like you're a little kid or like, you know, a first-year student just now learning this new concept, and it just shows this passion you have for what you do.
I used to be, people would say, you're a good ecologist when I was, you know, doing work with deer and stuff. And I'd like to think that someday I would be a good ecologist. And now I feel I have this ability if you go out with the neighbor kids and their moms in on a nature walk, and you know they think I can answer any of their questions. Well, I can answer a lot of their questions, and they pick something up, and I get a thrill of saying, well, you know, that's why are those berries together in a little pile? And, you know, did someone put them there? And they look at me, and then one of them will say, no, probably not. Some animal did that. And they say, what kind of animal? I don't know, but let's look closely. And then there's a bowl dropping. And I show them to them, yeah, that's what it is. And then they feel so good. And then they tell me, oh, Dave knows everything. No, I don't know everything. But I can learn by having my eyes open, and I want the kids to learn the same way. So I don't know more than people that are out there observing too. And the native people are closer to, you know, what I am. They're generally ecologists because they've learned the hard way, but they haven't been trained to answer some of the questions that I've have advantage over them on.
It's that being a keen observer. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Being a keen observer and the ability to interpret.
Yeah, observing and then thinking it through and putting the pieces together.
What bugs me now about education is I see we're turning out young people with PhDs in biology and they don't have adequate ecological training. But they're doing spectacular work, say, interpreting with DNA, and then they make the assumption, and some of their advisors are guilty of leading them to think that they are ecologists, these young people, partly because their advisors aren't really ecologists either, and they may be a specialist in DNA and species identification and taxonomy and know all the rules and regulations about that. And they may have done good field work themselves, but they go out in the field and the goal was to get tissue material. And so they have to learn something about where the animals are, and they may be satisfied with hair samples or where they get DNA from, or feces and things like that, which is good. But they don't ask questions about the ecology they could from that. They're so focused on their particular field of expertise. So they don't, they're not interested. If I ask them a question, well, what was in the fecal samples that you got, what were they eating? Well, we could do that with DNA. Why didn't they do it. They say, well, somebody else can do that because I'm a specialist in that other area. But when they're interviewed by the media, then and the media asks a question that you have to understand ecology to answer it, and you can't answer it if you don't have some ecology. They could have, if they were good observers, they could have answered the question, but they speculate, and oh man, some of the statements they make, and as an expert, and they're treated as an expert ecologist by the media. And one of them, I won't mention names, has got a PhD here, and she did a good job, and she was focused on modeling. And she was, then she's on the faculty now, and she's doing good work, working with a group of modelers, and they were doing some modeling of caribou information and habitat relationships, which was good. They were using some of the satellite imagery to get at some of the complexities of in ground truthing some of that. But then she was interviewed by the press. This was months ago, and they asked her, "Well, what's the future with climate warming for caribou?" And she said, "Oh, this caribou are so adaptive that they move around. You know, they cover vast areas when they're feeding. They'll just move." And you know, the person that was interviewed said, "Well, where are they going to move to?" Well, you have to ask that question as an ecologist. There has to be a habitat that will support them that isn't already occupied, mm-hmm. and it has is it kind of habitat that they need? Well, she was hooked on this idea that caribou will move. Therefore, if there's a disaster and a big fire in the winter range, they'll go someplace else. Well, they will, but if you have too many fires, there's no place else to go.
Right, or they'll go someplace where there are already caribou and there'll be too many and it can't be sustained.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think you're a good ecologist.
Well, I feel
now,
I'm an ecologist now.
You now feel you've attained that?
I think I've obtained that status. But you got to keep at it.
When you do, and that's what's very impressive.
And I know, and the minute I step outside, you know, I'm seeing things, and I'm trying to, if I'm seeing, you know, like spruce seeds laying on the ground. Why are there so many spruce seeds laying on the ground? Well, the reason is that we had several, 6 or 7 years when we had virtually no white spruce seed production, partly because they only produce seeds on the best conditions once every 3 or 4 years. But why it went so long this time was because we had a spruce budworm, which ate the flowering part. And so the spruce trees didn't produce any seed. And then they only produce it if you got enough. It's not a summer drought, which we had too in the past. So here we had, we didn't have a sun drought this year. And
no, we did not.
And the squirrels population, the red squirrel population went down because there wasn't a lot of spruce seed around. But some of them survived and eating black spruce seed and whatever. And then they came back, but they couldn't begin to cut all those cones up there. And white spruce cones open up. And as soon as it gets cold and or even dry at the... They had a long, plenty of length of growth season, and so these seeds were coming down. Normally, all those cones would be cut by the squirrel.
Oh, right.
There's seeds everywhere, and they were out on the deck, and I commented to Ned that
your neighbor
that have seen all the spruce seeds on the deck, and I said, and then I see grouse walking down there, and the driveway. And what are they doing picking? Well, I walked out there, and it's the spruce trees everywhere. The voles are out there picking it up. This was mostly about a couple of months ago before the snow came. And then I saw a nuthatch on the roof of the woodshed from upstairs. I looked out the window, and it was down there. And it was picking these seeds off the roof. And, oh, this is very unusual, but these animals are very optimistic.
They're all very excited.
Opportunistic and taking advantage of everything. And I brought this to Ned's attention. He said, wow, that was a good analysis of all of that. I would never have thought of that. He doesn't think.
Well, but that's what you say. You're a good ecologist. You're curious.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, just what you said, that you go outside and your brain immediately, you're seeing all the stuff, you're looking at it, you're interpreting, you're asking questions, you're putting it all together. Not everybody does that.
I know. I realize that.
And that's a wonderful quality.
But I need to explain things psychologically now. If I see something, why is that so? And I can do that even, picking up a seashell on the beach. I can ask these questions. Well, why is the shell here? And then I can answer a lot of questions if I know a lot about seashells. I don't know a hell of a lot, but I know enough that, I can answer some.
But I think, you're a good example of how being curious and being observant and asking questions and being passionate.
Yeah.
All of those things have combined to, make you a good ecologist, I guess.
Right.
It's a good example. That you said that being out with the neighbor kids, they get excited because you're excited.
Well, that's
and you're teaching
one of
them.
The reasons why I'm out there. I like to see kids excited, and I like to see them learn. And I appreciate if I'm one that's stimulating that too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that shows you enjoy teaching.
And they love me, and I love them too, as a result of that.
And you enjoy teaching, whether it's a 3-year-old or a 20-year-old. That gives you pleasure to see somebody learn.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, it's, as I say, it's a good role model, the joys of being curious. That at any age, we should all continue to be curious.
I'm curious about people, too. Try to understand people. And when I was younger, I didn't think, you as a child, you're doing that subconsciously, you like some people, you adults, and you like teachers, some of them more than others, and grandparents, some of them have a good way to interact with kids, and others may be a little bit aloof, and so, I realized my daughter lives in Homer's just like me. I mean, she can think about people and why are they smiling now or why are they not happy or something like that, and tries to understand. And I'm the same way. And so it's somewhat in our genes, but if I go in and I'm traveling and I, in the airport waiting for the plane, I usually have something to read and I sit down, but I'm more fascinated by watching people. And then I see a, family coming through with kids, and I try to figure out their ethnic origin by their parents and maybe clothing. And then I see the relationships between parents and kids. And sometimes, they're really pretty much under control. Sometimes they're totally out of control. And sometimes that out of control is the kid's nature. And some kids are so hardwired that it's hard to keep them under control. Others are out of control because the parents didn't keep them under control. And they're the ones that the parents suddenly realize they're not being considerate of people sitting down and banging this back of their seats and seeing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's you're doing the same thing. That example you just did field work of humans in the airport, is the same as going to the top of the mountain and watching that group of sheep interact and do what they do and how the parents raise the young. And you're doing the same thing, whether it's animals or people.
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah, it is. And, of course, I'm doing it from a male perspective, too. So, I mean, an attractive woman is going to attract my attention closer, more than a guy just walking there. But in the guy, too, because I, you know, I'm trying to get an idea what kind of a guy he is.
And, but you see, I do it, too. I watch people and try and figure out and observe and why they're doing what. And we all, well, I don't know if we all do it, but at least we, you and I do it.
When this black woman was here from the
Jehovah's Witness.
Jehovah's Witness. Then I, at one point I said, yeah, the, look at the problem in the world. And we were speaking and agreeing with one another. And I said, yeah, the, a lot of the problems in this world are stem from our history, and you know, like the Bible was written by men, and it's male dominated. But we're changing now, and that men are not changing very well. They're not doing it gracefully, and she kind of sparkled and she said, I see what you mean, and yes, I think. She agreed with me, which was surprising to me, because I said that before I stopped and think, how is it going to, how does this relate to religion?
But your, this interest, you know, you said you're curious about people, too. That does fit with, you know, your interest in archaeology and the peopling of the world, and it all fits. It's all part of being an ecologist. Humans are part of ecology, right?
Exactly, yeah.
You know, and not all people who study biology or who study physics or who study chemistry care about the human side. And so to me, that feels unique in that you're interested in archaeology and prehistory as much as you are in biology. Do you think that's unique?
I think it probably is. There are other people like me, but it's really unique.
Where does that come from, do you think, in you?
It came from my parents, the genes. And, you know, partly because of these interviews, especially the earlier ones about my youth, I mean, you know, it forced me to think a lot about sometimes I can't go to sleep at night, but even if I just think about it when something comes up and I realize, yeah, I realize how important it was. My father or my grandfather or my mother emphasized this when I was a boy, because they were good at seeing what the potential of their three children were. Mm-hmm. And we all benefited from that in different ways. And, and I think parents should think more about that themselves when they're raising their kids. They do, but they're not really conscious or thinking about it.
You mean thinking about the influence that they have on their children and who their children will become?
Yeah. Now, and when you look back in our history and we just, you know, deal with, say, gender, the change in gender relationships, you know, and historically, you look at some of these famous men whose, look at what their fathers were. know, if they were a university professor, or fathers were a lawyer, a university professor, or a medical doctor, they usually wanted their son to be the same.
Right.
And for women who are achievers, it's not as clear cut because we don't measure achievement the same way for
right.
women. But for, say, artists, it was some cases the mother was an artist or the father was an artist. And they then saw artistic ability in the young person and did what they could. And the same with music and outstanding musicians. The parents were usually musicians too, but they, not all of the kids in their family were famous musicians, became famous musicians. But the ability to see these talents in their kids and then try to help them, develop them.
Well, you help nurture them, encourage them.
Yeah, but to understand that the potential is there in some versus others.
Right.
And that's it's not an absolute way of doing it because you hear some of these interviews on public radio about of musicians and they mentioned that what finally turned them on because it was just understood that you'd be all be able to be musical like they were, their parents, but they didn't expect that they would be special, and it suddenly, click, they got stimulation, but it was usually their parents setting a role model for them, not necessarily directing them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with actors. And
well, what about you? Do you have something with particular that went click for you? I mean, your parents were not ecologists or scientists.
No, but both of them were keen observers. My mother, for plants and wildflowers,
right.
I mean, she knew
right.
them.
Right.
And she
and
knew
your grandfather.
Knew the seasonality. And my father was an ardent outdoors person, but unfortunately, you know, he wasn't around as much
right.
as we'd would have liked. But
So you don't have any one thing where that click happened?
No, it didn't click once. Was there were two things. One was music. I mean, I like music, but in the school when I was in the public school when I moved down from Vermont, of course, there was no music in public schools in little communities and. Moved on and went for several years in Hartford in big classes and no music. And then out to this village for the seventh and eighth grade where they were both in the same room. And there were once a month a music teacher came for the four rooms, all eight grades, so he spent a little bit of time in each one, and we were supposed to learn to read music. I was not a good reader, period. And I thought, oh, what a waste of time learning to read music. And now I regret that so much, that if I had gotten to read music, I probably would have been able to, you know, plunk away on the piano or the guitar or something and even do something. And the same with, my father was musically inclined and he had lessons violin and he had a violin and he when they only had one, well, the oldest daughter was 6 years older than me and 4 years older than her middle brother, and she had some violin lessons, and Dad also was thought he was going to teach her to play the violin too. But I never saw him play the violin that was up on the shelf. And the reason I didn't is because the only time I was, when I was that age, I was interested. He was then working these long shifts and so much to do at home, rebuilding this home. And then he would help with the gardening, and there wasn't time for it. And so that sort of explained things to me, because I wished I had had some more focus on music. Mm-hmm. And then art was sort of the same way. My mother had training in art, and she had one job painting china.
Right.
And mostly floral designs. But she loved flowers, and she had a nice eye. She played it down and saying, well, you know, I was just copying. But she wasn't. I mean, they said what they wanted, and they had pictures and also a flower displays to work from.
You didn't pick up the art ability?
Well, see, I was good at drawing, and I was one of these really slow guys that I could take a picture of a train and a railroad station and kind of do it line drawing, and without any training. And so that was when we had moved down to Hartford, and so Dad had gotten the job, and so my mother suggested that maybe it would be worthwhile to have some lessons in art. And it was in, we were living in the city then, and so she checked, and there was a deal with a woman was, you'd meet one or two days a week, mm-hmm. something like that, and it was for kids. And I was about fourth, fifth grade maybe at that time. Or third or fourth, probably. It was probably third or fourth. And I went there. And I was a very shy guy. And very... I didn't appreciate any capabilities I had. I knew that I liked to draw, and my mom and brother and sister knew that, and I was doing okay in that. And so here I went to this, they had to drop me off there, I had to take a bus, I think, and show me where to go, and then she came back, and when I got out and went back home with her. And, that was a disaster for me. Because she wanted, here there weren't that many kids, like there must have been six of us. And, okay, this is what you do. You get the paper. Now I want you to take a crayon, colored crayon, and make a slash like this on the paper. And I... This isn't what I expected. And a couple of those things, and see how nice a curve you can make to it. And then she'd go around and look, and, oh, she'd say, no, that doesn't look very good, you know. At the end of that session, I had nothing to do with my interests and capabilities. And... So after it was over, and Mom came and picked me up, and she said, well, how did it go? And I said, I really felt bad, because I felt that must be something wrong with me, because I didn't feel like I connected at all. And I told what happened, and I had thought that she would let us do our own thing and then correct, you know, something like that. And then I could handle that. But so then I remember, you know, talking to my mom quite a bit about, and she too, because it costs money.
Right.
And I said, I think it's a waste of money, because I just didn't connect at all with her. And so that was it. And but she made this effort, and I appreciated that. And but then it was my shortcomings of getting focused on other things and not carrying on that. When I took a course in high school, I took biology. I loved that. And the instructor wanted us to draw pictures of plants and things like that, of different kinds. And I loved doing that. And I got a good grade. That was one of the few courses I got a good grade in. And I learned a lot about biology, because I was keenly interested, obviously. And then I had always had a keen eye about landscape and architectural design and what. So I've used my this art capabilities, and I've studied on these areas I was interested in, and landscape design too. I did some studies of different countries, and especially Japanese gardens and what. And when I've been over there once or twice for a conference, and I've made a point of visiting some of those, and those are just so beautifully done, and realize the ability of the people that put it together. They're not just gardeners, they're artists.
Yeah.
And so at any rate, I have a real appreciation for art, and that's good. That's fine, because I would have been bored being an artist and not being able to move around in the environment and learn more about it.
Yeah, so do you feel like what you've ended up doing, being an ecologist, was the right path?
Yeah. There are times when I was fascinated with architecture, but it was more residential architecture, and building and carpentry and stuff. And then I was stimulated to think more about architecture and design. And I would think, I could have been happy as an architect, and probably would have eventually been a good one. But then I thought, being a biologist is much better, because biology, you learn about yourself and as well as about the rest of the environment that you live in. And that, to me, if you know more about yourself, you get along better in the world than if you don't. And then ecology, of course, helps you to understand your place in the world. Like, sometimes when I was a boy, and you'd have the stars all out, and we'd be out and go outside, and and we learned some of the constellations from Dad. But I got fascinated in that. But it was, you know, I remember my dad particularly, you know, said, you know, just imagine, you know, how small you are relative to the universe, and we're only seeing a portion of it, that how you're so insignificant, and yet we're here together, and that it's good to have a feeling of not being the world that we know, the center of the universe. And I appreciated those kind of experiences when you're out there and you see. And when I was drafted in the Army down at Fort Richardson, basic training, and that was in the 50s, so it was, Anchorage was a little different then, but one of the things they had to do is guard duty. Mm-hmm. Well, it was guard duty up on the hillside where there were these ammo deals, big concrete things and locked doors and what. And it was just a little road that you could get up there with a four-wheel drive truck on. But it was up on the hillside, and it was kind of nice. You could go up there, and at first, I didn't take a flashlight, but I finally got a small flashlight because I could get up there, and sometimes I could see these good stars and walk around in pitch black, and there weren't a lot of lights then, and the way it was facing to the west, I think, and you get so you can walk carefully with the minimum amount of light without tripping and stuff, and moving slowly, and keeping moving. It was, I think, early winter, and so you should keep moving, and we had good clothing, and to just be up there and not do anything was then so boring, and so you get burnt out so fast. And I'd wander around, and then I finally took this little flashlight, and I got this map of the heavens that would fold up, and I could keep that in my pocket, and then pull that thing out and take this. And you weren't supposed to have a light up there when you're doing this, but I'd, you know, cover the light, and then I'd locate these constellations. And so I was learning constellations. That was fun. I enjoyed doing that. But it was, that's kind of experiences where you feel how small you are when you're out there and you're looking at the heavens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'd say, you know, talking to you and watching you, to me, it feels like you made the right choice. Biology and ecology, it excites you. You have passion. It has to have been the right choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You've had a very successful career and continue to.
This deal about the rocks here out at St. Matthew and the birds, you know, when I came up here and spent this year in Alaska, then I went back after a year. I knew what I was going for, to the University of Connecticut, and to do an undergraduate degree. And I had some credits I could transfer from here, mm-hmm. and military service. But one of the electives I could take in the sciences was geology. And yeah, that was definitely one I wanted to take. And man, that I clobbered that thing. There were all of these things about landforms, and I'd seen it in Alaska, and it's just short time I've been here, whereas back in New England, and you know, the forests, and you didn't see the rock formations or anything. You knew that the highest mountain was there, which I'd climbed in Mount Washington, but you didn't see much exposed rock. And here, and the meandering, flying up into the brook streams of meandering rivers, and I could, you know, I could understand all those things. When I, in the geology, I was so fascinated by it. And I got the highest grade in the class. And the professors talked to me and he said, are you going to continue on in geology? And I said, no, I'm wildlife. But I could have continued on, but I was already committed to living systems.
Yes.
But landforms, you know, that is, fascinates me.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And when I'm flying, I frequently want a window seat. If it's going to be daylight, I want to see the landforms.
Yeah, me too.
And then in the lower 48, you know, you're reading a lot of things about agriculture and irrigation, and you realize that, you know, there's vast areas with no people. Or you don't see much sign of people. You see the occasional road and
Little farmhouse.
And little farmhouse, and then suddenly, bingo, as people everywhere and buildings all over the place. And rivers and stuff, and then you can, you know, reconstruct why the cities are where they are, and these rivers, and have a little bit of history of the country, and so it's fascinating. And the same when I'm flying in over Europe, I mean, trying to relate to what I know about the countries, and that's to me very fascinating.
Yeah. Well, you had talked about, you know, how there's some musicians or artists who say they have this spark that made them want to do what they do. And we've talked about all these influences in your growing up that led you to do what you do. Can you relate anything to a spark that was a particular moment or that inspired you, or was it just all of this put together?
All of it put together, yeah. I was typical young guy too, and you know, playing with other guys, and enjoyed, you know, touch football and things like that, where all these things outside, and a little bit of softball, yeah, and regretting that things that I'd like to do in terms of activities weren't too realistic, like I weren't in a good place to learn to play tennis and things like that, which I thought, well, that should be fun. And
but yeah, so the path you've taken with your career is sort of the accumulation of all these experiences along the way.
You're right.
Okay.
Gardening, plants growing, and helping out that.
And liking to be outdoors. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
It's interesting to think about, as you say, how we become who we are.
It is, and some of it is, it's sort of out of your control, really. And I realize some of the, my own son, for example, I was sort of disappointed that he wasn't more assertive in trying to decide what he wanted to be. But he was sort of doing the same thing as I was. Not that he didn't turn out like me, but he turned out to be a terrific guy, and he turned out to be to develop his own capabilities, which was mainly management of people and work and accomplishing things that way. And he did it on his own, sort of, and that's what I did. But I never tried to push him, but he was felt pushed a little bit because my wife, his mom, you know, she saw that these kids had a big potential, and she had a college education, and I did, and so figured college was way to go. And I think my son was perhaps didn't want to compete with me. He was interested in a lot of the same things. He didn't want to compete with me.
So he did something else?
Yeah, it started out that way.
Yeah. But it's true, we all are a combination of our genes and our upbringings and those influences, but we're also the people we meet along the way, whether they're friends, whether they're teachers and mentors.
Yeah.
The experiences we have, all of that builds on itself. I mean, your childhood, you're coming to Fairbanks for that year and their time out in the Brooks Range, that influenced you. Your research that you did for your PhD, I mean, all of that makes us who
we
are.
Yeah, there were highlights, and you know, that Brooks Range thing was an important part of being here. I mean, driving all the way up here and into Fairbanks isn't the most scenic part of Alaska. I didn't go down on the Kenai, then. That came later. And I was just lucky that I went to the Brooks Range. And that's a special area, too. And I was turned on by mountains.
Yeah.
And that was sort of turned on by mountains before then, but... And it was partly that the life zones are so different from the bottom of the mountain on up. And that was fascinated me. And so that diversity of life zones and the work I did when I was starting my master's on with mountain sheep and going, I mean, that was nirvana for me. I remember stopping and thinking a couple times. Here, just a short time ago, I was back in Connecticut, and I just didn't realize how beautiful the world is, and especially this part of the world. And I loved the environment I was in Connecticut, working in the state forests. It was pretty pristine. There was a few deer left in there, and a natural hardwood forest, and I learned, a hell of a lot. And with help from my mom when I was younger, I knew the wildflowers and was learning more and learned. And forestry, I was fascinated with learning about the different trees and had a good understanding. And then working for the state forest, other guys had learned a different kind of woods, and you work with them, cutting them down, or some made into lumber. And I mean, all of these things were fascinating for me. And then that related to, understanding the Northwoods and how it was Southern New England, was going back to forests now after it had been settled and people had gone west, and especially in Vermont, it was so rocky and wet that people finally pulled up stakes and went west.
Yeah.
And so some few farms remained, but you go out in the woods and you see these old foundation sites.
Right,
and,
with the rock walls or things, yeah. Well, all this time we've been doing all this talking about all your accomplishments and successes and the students you trained and all that, we haven't talked anything about some of the
failures.
regrets or sometimes we've talked about challenges, but are there any of those failures, regrets type things you want to talk about?
Last night when I was there at that event and Bernie Carl came over and talked to me. And then two or three other people came over. I had three conversations going on at the same time. And then they all kept changing because when someone would come over, they would talk differently. And there was someone else there that was in it that had to do with... Bernie, someone made some comment about Bernie's disappointment And he was so upbeat about the being that
The new governor Walker,
and a lot, but someone said, "Well, were you disappointed about others?" And he said, "No, you got to take these things as they come. I take every day as it comes, and I've never had a bad day in my life." He said, "Never had a bad day," and so then I jokingly said, I just had one that wasn't so good when my computer screwed up. And he said something about, you know, every time I get up in the morning, I just know it's going to be a good day for me. And it turns out it is.
And that's how you feel?
Well, we discussed that a little bit, and... And then, yeah, that's how I feel. Then I thought, you know, when that thing screwed up, and I immediately said, "Well, what do I do now?" And I said, "Well, what I do is I've got it saved on, as I was doing, on a couple of flash drives, but they're not too well organized. I'll have to search for them. How will I search for them? And, well, why don't I use the Apple computer?" I mean, I could go upstairs to the computer up there, which is slow, but I could have done it up there. And I could have gone to the university, where I've got another old laptop that sits there that would probably work as a PC. And so I said, "No, I mean, it's not a disaster. There's plenty of time left. And again, I can probably get this thing fixed." I said, that's a high priority. And then I could, while I'm waiting, I'll try working in Apple. I did all that. And then in retrospect, at the end of that day, I thought, well, I've almost got this one done on Apple, and I've learned how to use that. And that's good. So I tend to see the positive side of any situation that... And people have asked me, you know, why aren't you worried about something or other? And even if it's, you know, say a health problem or something like that. Well, no, I want to know about it. And then chances are worrying won't do any good. And if it's a friend that's having problems, yeah, I'm concerned about them, but worrying about it doesn't do much good. Worry doesn't do much good. And so that, how do you handle stress? Well, I'd say avoid stress because I try not to worry about things. And if things are pile on me, then I try to respond to the challenge. And if it's real stressful, adrenaline kicks in, and I can handle it. And it's just as if you're out there in the woods and you're out on the road and your car broke down. Well, you got to deal with it. And the best thing is to deal with it, not to worry about it. It's not a disaster. And try to avoid disasters. So be careful and don't do risky things that are unnecessary to be risky.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does sound like, you know, your computer example shows the responding to the challenge as well.
Yeah.
This is what happened. Well, okay, I'll learn a new program, and being open to those new experiences, yeah. And that it's not... that it's a challenge and it's a learning opportunity, not that it's a disaster.
Yeah.
Sounds like what
and if
your
you,
approach.
And what's the worst case scenario? Well, it's one you can't figure out any other alternative. Well, when that comes, well, it comes.
So you'll face it when it happens.
Yeah.
So is that to say that you have no failures and regrets? well, along the way.
What do you call a failure?
I don't know. You used the word failure, so
no,
I don't know.
That's true. I mean, it's all what you call a failure. It's when, you know, my wife and I broke up and had a divorce. It wasn't first wife. It wasn't because we didn't love one another and we didn't enjoy sharing being parents of three great kids. And for me, it would have happened earlier if the kids weren't there. But the kids held us together, and I don't regret that. I think that was a positive thing. Mm-hmm. And it was a tough one because there was another woman involved. And that was a tough one. But, yeah, it was the kids. It kept us together, and then that was positive because when you got kids and as well as a wife, then it's a family, and the love is spread out. And so it, and, you know, the hard part was, you know, how did the kids interpret this? Well, the first time we separated once, then, well, that's true. That was the first time there was another woman involved. But then, when coming to the reality of breaking up the family and not being involved with the kids as a family was what kept me together, and the other woman had a child too, and it was the same situation, more complicated for her than for me because she was from Denmark. And so it was, and we could have made a new life together, but the loss would have been a big one for both of us. And it wouldn't have been total loss in terms of your relationship to your kids, but it would have been a loss that would have been substantial because the kids wouldn't have been such an important part of my life. And the kind of things that you think about differently in the stage of their children growing up, and, well, marriage, and then having kids, and then carrying on. And then humans are vulnerable to, especially when you're in a situation where you're interacting with lots of other people and you're in a position of, you know, easily falling in love with outstanding people that you meet.
So how old were your children then when you divorced?
That was, Laura was 17, the youngest one.
Okay.
And then so she was ready to leave at 18.
Yeah. So
and
you
go
waited
on her own.
You waited until they were grown.
Yeah.
And so how many years was that between the initial separation and then that decision to,
well, that initial separation was about a month, I guess.
No, but How much longer after that did you stay married? It was how many years that you stayed for the kids?
It was probably about 8 years.
Okay.
Yeah. Or nine, something like that.
And then you've had two other marriages since?
No, one other marriage and then a partner.
Oh, right. Okay.
So then the second marriage was after I had been divorced probably about 3 or 4 years. And, you know, had a couple of close relationships then. In fact, one that I regretted a little bit because it was love with a grad student who was from Thailand, but her mom had divorced her father and then moved with her to the U.S. She had married an American, and they lived in Anchorage, and she did her undergraduate in Anchorage and came here to do graduate work in political science, I think it was. And she was a good friend of one of my students. But she wanted to get married, and she wanted kids right away, but she was brilliant in person and just terrific personality, and I'm ready to start over again. And so I didn't want to go that route. And then a year or so after that, I met Luann, who was an impressive woman who had, in many ways, she had grown up in Seward and Anchorage, and she had family down in Anchorage, and yeah, mainly in Anchorage, and brother and sister and parents, and that she had finally divorced her husband, who was an alcoholic. But after five boys, and never could quite understand why she waited so long. But and she worked her butt off, had some help from her parents, but you know, mostly was eked her way along, and she and raised these kids and these boys, and they lived in Juneau for a while, and she had jobs that weren't big paying jobs, but they were, she could get by just barely financially, and probably food stamps and things
and
like
that. And is that who, the house on Chena Ridge, is that who you built that for?
No, that was
some that part, was for Heather.
Heather, yeah.
Okay.
So at any rate, this Luann, she was a fun person, but we had different value systems, and she was lucky. She had, her sons had good genes and did well. She finally was able to part-time go to school and get a bachelor's in, what was it? Psychology, is that what? Anyway, she got a job with as a parole officer with the court system here in Fairbanks.
So you were married to her for how long?
About 10 years.
Okay. I'm sure you've already told me this before. I can't, but
I'd have to check on the dates.
I have to check the dates on when you and Aileen were married and divorced, and we can get all those dates, I'm sure,
right,
at some point. Okay. So it sounds like a little bit, since we started this topic of failures, regrets, disappointments, it sounds like you're...
I don't consider them failures. I I realized that my future wasn't headed in a good direction with Luann, because she got burned out up here and she didn't like it. And then she tried all these things. She was not good at financing, and so we got together and it was going to be a shared partnership, but pretty soon she wanted to get training as a counselor, which she did, conflict counselor, and she went down to Vancouver, where there was a good place to do it and could do it in about 5 months or so, intensive. And I admired her going, but she wasn't very realistic and understanding in that they would, in financing, she said they wouldn't take a loan from me, no interest loan to do this. And we didn't get married at first. So we got married late after we'd been together for quite a while. And she, then she had some retirement and she said, I'll just use my retirement. I said, no, don't use your retirement. That doesn't make sense at all. Just take a loan and you can pay it back if if worse comes to worse, there's no crime, and you can capable of doing it. But she wanted to start her business after she had this training here in Fairbanks. And it was unrealistic. She wanted to start, with a nice office and everything. And you don't start that kind of work that way. You got to have a lot of people that are coming to you. If you're going to do that, you got to build a reputation. She knew that other places, other people in town that were busy, they didn't have a big fancy office. And she wanted to do it right, and she thought that would attract people. Well, that isn't what it attracts people. And then her brother in Anchorage was a counselor too, and he had one of these doctorates that you could get in short order. And he was an okay counselor, I think, but she relied heavily on him and wanted to work with him, which would have been a mistake, because he was worse than she was in finances. And anyway, it was getting more and more that she didn't like living here. And then she, of course, wanted to be close to her boys as much as possible. They had all went down. No, they didn't. There were still two here, and one of them lived with us and finished up a master's here, a brilliant guy, in physiology, yeah. And the boys were all tall, handsome young guys, and really done amazingly well for.
Mm-hmm. Now, but what about in your professional life? Anything, disappointments or regrets, or failures, whatever you want to call them? Negatives.
Well, disappointments. There's a lot of disappointments when you start writing papers and you submit them and they don't get accepted for varying reasons. And sometimes you feel that it wasn't a fair review, et cetera, et cetera. And the best thing to do, it's just like a writer, is modify it if you feel it's the review is critical, and justify it and resubmit to. And that's, you have to learn to do that. And that's not easy, but it's true of anything you do. And if you try and it doesn't work out too well, then you can usually, if your motivation is there, you think that maybe you could do a better job and get over it. I didn't have a lot of that kind of stuff because everything seemed to happen before I really wanted it to happen, but it happened. I never thought I would be back on the faculty and so wildlife unit leader so soon after I left Connecticut. And just everything happened so fast, and including having this do the military service the second time, and then
everything fell in place well for you. Is it luck? Is it?
I don't think it wasn't luck, because I had the motivation and goal. Well, the decision to go on for a PhD, I mean, I could have stuck with Fish and Game. I had a good job, and the head of my boss thought I was groom me. They didn't have a subsistence division. He thought that I would be a good person because I had already had experience with Native people and understand them, that I'd be a good person to head up subsistence division. I'm sure I could have moved up, and I would have enjoyed that kind of work, but it would be too much administration and focus on administration, and that's that. And as wildlife unit leader, you know, you had administration, but I always, in my own mind, if people asked me, I said, I want to use some minimum amount of my time for administration, but it has to be done because you got to keep the funding coming in for the students, et cetera. But my real interest is working with the students and doing some of my own research.
Right, going out in the field.
Yeah.
Well, so it sounds like not luck, but taking advantage of opportunities when they presented themselves? Is that more what you'd say?
Yeah, and motivation, yeah. Maintaining the motivation. And it's the same when, you know, then I have learned a hell of a lot from advising so many students, which I have had to select from paper in the early days. There was no way of meeting the students before you, unless they happened to be from coming through the undergraduate program here, but mostly they didn't. Mostly they were from some other state or other country. And then even then, frequently, it was all correspondence, and you had their CV, and sometimes you didn't even have a picture of them. It was on the paper, and the three letters of recommendation, and you learned to do the best you could with this material you had to work with, and there was a real person there, and some of the letters would be, from the young person's minister. And it didn't tell you much. But three letters, maybe there was something there. At least there were three letters. And then the grades, you look at the grades and you go down through there and they could be better in this area, But their mean is okay, but the main thing usually was the letter they had to write. And you got a little bit of a clue on their motivation, but the real tough ones were the ones that had excellent grades, but they were coming from New York City or something like that. And they've ever been any place besides New York City or that general area. And here's Alaska. Some never been to Alaska, and some of those were, the excellent grades, and if they're excellent grades and letters and everything, and you had the money lined up, and so you had you'd gone through all these applications that were coming in, and you ended up with 3 or 4, and how do you make the, or maybe you don't end up with a 3 or 4, you end up one that you don't think is good enough, but not that the other ones did. So you make a decision sometimes that you just hope for the best. And I tend to be super, it's not luck, of course, but others thought it was lucky that I ended up with top-notch students. But I also ended up with some students that I had tremendous respect for, and they started out and they did, I thought, this is going to be great. This is a good person. They enjoyed the field work and everything. And then they were brilliant young people. And some of those brilliant ones have a hard time. They had a hard time because they couldn't focus in very well. They didn't know what they wanted to do.
So not every student that you selected for the program was successful.
Well, the ones that I admired the most are the ones that after they went out in the field for the first time, and they came back in and they said they think they really don't want a master's degree in wildlife, and someone would say, well, I need some more time to think about things, and they had done excellent work and the courses that they were taking and everything, and they were just top-notch students. And they came in and they were very apologetic, and they said, "We realize, you know, you've already spent this money, but I don't think we should go. I won't feel good about going through with it." And so I would say, then I really appreciate your doing this and also, you know, being open about it now. And obviously it's the best thing for you to do is something that you feel good about continuing. And rather than being pissed off with them. So I would usually say, well, if you need a letter, I'll write one for you, but I really appreciate your being straightforward about this, and I'm disappointed because I thought it would work out well, but it's best that this experience of the graduate program is yours and not mine or others. And so I had two or three like that, The master's level, I never had any. I had a couple that dropped out, but never that didn't that flunked out.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a couple of one PhD that didn't finish, but he could have, but he got a job. He was Canadian, got a job in British Columbia, and didn't need a PhD. Mm-hmm. And he did good things. And he was married, and there was a financial issue, too. And that's understandable. And then there was one woman she didn't pass her comprehensive exam, and frankly, by that time, there was a little hope that you would. And that was, I felt bad about that because she was a very nice person. And I did not want to accept her because she had done so poorly on the GREs. And her grades were not outstanding at all. And she had done a so-called master's degree working in Africa with some primate, wild primate. And I was wary because here is a very nice person, seemed intelligent, but there was no documentation of any intelligence. And I had this funding for a study on, and she didn't, she just wanted a PhD. She didn't, she wanted to be admitted, and her GRE scores were so low, I thought, there's a problem here. And so, but she'd come and started in at before she applied for the PhD.
Yeah.
So she wanted to, you know, that's reasonable. And she wanted to, you know, get her feet on the ground or what. And I could see that she was just mentally naive, let's put it that way. She was attractive, and she had boyfriend problems. And the type of boyfriends, it didn't impress me at all. But I became a good friend with her, and she, you know, I told her about this project and had to write up an outline with, it was studying the tundra hare out in the Seward Peninsula. And went out there in the field with her, and she wasn't a top-notch skier, but it was, and we could get around on skis together, and she was gung-ho about field work and competent, and but I couldn't get her to write or outline what she wanted to do. She just took the things that I'd written to get the funding, and that's, she said, this is what I'll do. And I said, no, that's, you have to develop a proposal, and this is just the question. We want to know more about, and how are you going to do it? She just could not get into it. And she, there was a student award to go to a meeting in Vladivostok related to mammalogy, and which, you know, it's okay if she applied, and she took this exact same thing that I had, and she submitted that, and she got her trip to. And then, we had to put this committee together. Well, I didn't want to accept her, but other faculty said, "No, she's going to be good. Look, she asks good questions when there's seminars sitting there, and she asks questions." But I didn't say they were good, and she was not inhibited about asking questions. Mm-hmm. That's nice, yeah. But and I was out there in the field, and we lived and stayed in the fishing game. They would stay in the bunkhouse, and we out there, and we did. I mean, she just didn't have a clue as to how to approach anything about this hair, but she said she was happy to do this. I realized I got to see something more.
Right.
And then she finally said she wanted to go to the North Slope in the winter and look to see whether this tundra hare was ever up there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it had already been written up, and nobody had ever found them up there, except there were a couple of reports of hares in Barrow, and but they weren't identified for sure. So they could have been snowshoe hares, and probably were. And on the west coast of Alaska, they go up just north of Kotzebue. And the archaeological work indicates that they haven't been up there beyond maybe Cape Thompson, maybe. Mm-hmm. There was one archaeological site, but that's so close to where they was a limit of their range now. And they had no record of them being on the North Slope. And so she had this idea, she wanted to go up there and look around in habitat where there were already snowshoe hares. And we could tell the difference in the wintertime because the tracks are different and the feces are different. And so I went up with her and we raced at Umiat and rented a couple of snow machines they had there. But she just didn't have a plan. She didn't have a plan. She couldn't. So I tried to, you know, well, where do you want to go? And what kind of, she hadn't studied the kind of habitat you should look into. And it was just like she was waiting for me to tell her what to do. And then came back and she, by this time she was just a very nice person.
So did she finish the program or no?
She, and then people on her committee included Dave Hopkins. He was all around paleo guy. And Joe Cook, who was a mammologist. And then the other one was John Bryant. You know, did you know John?
No, I don't know who he is.
A terrific scientist, but he was very He loyal friends. When he made friends, he was very loyal.
And he was in the biology wildlife department.
Yeah, he was a real star scientist here, and did his PhD here and published on secondary chemicals and worked with snowshoe hares. And but at any rate, then you know we were. She wasn't producing any outline of what she wanted to do or proposal. And then time was dragging on and she was getting a stipend and she wasn't producing. Her attitude would be, well, I'm working. I'm reading up on these things and I should be able to get something done. And then, it came time to do the comprehensive exam. Mm-hmm. And we told her in advance the kind of things she should study up on. And so she took the exam and it was a disaster. She just had not had a good undergraduate training or master's training at all. She didn't understand ecology or biology and that school she went to was a small liberal arts college, and we never did. She was never able to produce a master's thesis, which we said that we had to have that first. And she never produced it, and then it turned out that it wasn't really a master's thesis. That you got this master's because of some field work and coursework that you did. But it wasn't a thesis at all. And so she didn't have any training in science, et cetera. And she didn't have the ability to follow through. And then her mom came over. She was Scottish origin and really nice mom. And she flunked the comprehensive exam so badly that we had to tell her that she flunked, and she must have known that she did bad. But technically, she would have, you can take it over again. After a minimum of 6 months, you can do another try.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so bad, and I said, you know, we can tell her that, but frankly, I don't want to be her advisor if the John Bryant and who did I say the first one?
Dave Hopkins.
Dave Hopkins. They had both got to know her and thought she was just a sweet young woman, and which she was. And I said, I don't want to be your major professor, so one of you should take over. And oh, they said, no, we couldn't do it. You're the one that have to do it. And so at any rate, I told her that she had flunked, and that and she was really broken. And I think I'd mentioned this before, that you will have a second chance if you want to. But she realized she had literally done nothing, and I had this project that was funded, and I had to do something on it. And she wasn't going to follow through, and that was the last I saw her when I told her that. She left. I don't know where she went.
Well, and it sounds like it's disappointing to you that you had a student who didn't succeed.
It is, and then in retrospect, I sort of resented the fact that other faculty kind of pushed her on me. And I did have this funding, and she said she would, I mean, she would have said yes to anything. And her idea was, I think that if you, and that was probably with the master's, if you're around long enough and you're a nice person, you'll be awarded the degree. It's not that simple.
Yeah.
And Joe Cook, he was really disappointed with John Bryant and
Dave
Hopkins, because they weren't basing their judgment on, you know, she's such a nice person. They said she should be able to finish it. I said, I don't want to be her major professor, and I can't see her finishing if I'm her major professor, because she hasn't produced, and I've got to move ahead with this project. And
I can see how, you know, it's so important to you that you like teaching and you like to see people learn. So it would be disappointing.
Plus, I believe strongly in having standards. I mean, if you produce phony PhDs, it's bad for the program.
Right.
And so, Joe Cook stood beside me on that.
So many people who've gone through the program have nothing but praise for the wildlife program and the biology program and students who you've mentored.
And it's kind of ironic, because John Bryant was a brilliant student, and he's one of these guys, he had an interesting background. His father was a geologist, worked with mining companies, and he traveled around the world with his father. I think I don't know whether his mother, whether they were divorced, but he, you know, he got a lot of experience, worldly experience. He, super sharp guy, and he had did a master's degree at biostatistics at Calgary, and did this top-notch grade, and he got burned out on education, and he came up and hung out around. He got a dog team and hung out around Denali National Park, and he did long dog team trips first, and including northern Alaska and in some in Canada, and he, you know, being very competent and loved it and loved the dogs, and then he decided he'd want to do a degree. But just before that time, he had been married to Bryant.
Jane.
Yeah. And but they John was a very difficult guy in many ways. He was brilliant and loving and kind, but he also had a strong motivation and will, and so then he didn't know what he wanted to do. He was never quite sure whether he was doing the right thing for his own well-being, and so then they got divorced, and then he met Peggy, his wife, and still with him, and so she applied to do a master's degree with me. I accepted her, and she was a top-notch student, and she and John just had a great relationship, and John came and decided that, well, maybe since he's in the program, he'd come and be a field assistant for her, but he might want to start a degree program, PhD, at some time in the future. And that's just what he did. He was a field assistant for her, and she was lucky because he was such a sharp guy and capable in the field, and she became competent and good, and did a fine job on working with Western Arctic Caribou Herd on board selection, the post-calving time. And she did top-notch work, and John was very supportive and helped her, I'm sure. But she did just top-notch work. It was a good thesis. And then John applied to do a PhD to biology and wildlife.
I'm thinking that I'm going to turn off the recorder.
Go ahead, yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
It's getting late anyway.
Yeah, and it just doesn't have to be in there. But